Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to the generous supporters of the Peter B. Collins podcast, including John DeVries, who hails from Canada, and Leanne Royer of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Thank you for your support. If you can help, I'm much obliged. Go to my website at peterbcollins.com. And your voluntary subscription starts as low as $5 a month. Later in this program, we'll meet David DeGraw. He has a website called ampedstatus.com. And he's really concerned about the heist. It's called a bailout, but the heist by Wall Street bankers of our taxpayer money. And also on tap today, a fresh report from Tommy Panic, our in-depth, undercover, low-budget investigative reporter. He's been quiet recently. That means he's been undercover, and we'll peel back the cover and find out what he's been up to before the end of this podcast program. And to get us started, we're joined by Stephen Zunis. He is a professor of politics at USF. That's the University of San Francisco. And he writes for many publications, including Foreign Policy in Focus. And they are on the web at fpif.org. Stephen, good to talk with you again.
Good to be back.
Well, you wrote a piece published October 7 at Foreign Policy in Focus about the controversy over the Goldstone Commission report. And Sir Richard Goldstone is a respected South African jurist. And as you point out in your piece, he is a Zionist Jew.
Yep.
And despite that, he published a report that, from my knowledge, I have not read it word for word, but I've read news accounts and summaries of it, attempted to be even-handed in evaluating the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians as Israel conducted an onslaught of Gaza that they say was provoked. It started with a provocation on our election day just about a year ago, and the violence continued until just before the inauguration of President Obama. And during that time, Israel pounded the Gaza Strip mercilessly, in my view, and it was a very disproportionate conflict with disproportionate results. And in particular, the numbers I recall are that 1,400 Palestinians lost their lives and 14 Israelis, most of whom were soldiers, lost their lives in this conflict. So the Goldstone Report is now out, and the Obama administration appears to be in league with pro-Israeli forces, including AIPAC in this country, and they appear determined to just shred this report and try to make sure that it really never has any traction on Israel or the Palestinians.
Yes, it's quite remarkable. In fact, this report, led by one of the most respected authorities on international humanitarian law in the world, and consisting of three other well-respected authorities that have done in similar investigations regarding Rwanda, Yugoslavia, Darfur, other places. In fact, Justice Goldstone was one of the chief prosecutors in both the Yugoslavia and Rwanda war crimes tribunals. And initially, the UN Human Rights Council, which authorized this report, wanted them just to look at the violations of international humanitarian law by the Israelis, but the Goldstone and the others refused unless the mandate was broadened to look at both sides. And they did indeed look at both sides, very critical of Hamas, of course, for lobbing shells into civilian areas of Israel, not to mention the repression of Palestinian opponents inside the territory and their continued holding of a kidnapped Israeli soldier. But you know, the report also went into details about how that this was a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish and humiliate and terrorize a civilian population. So they were very clear about the Israeli violations. They cited a number of incidents where Israeli forces engaged in direct attacks against civilians, including situations where people were shot while trying to leave their homes to walk to a safer place waving white flags. It was quite consistent, this report, with a similar, very lengthy, detailed report by Human Rights, by Amnesty International.
Mm-hmm.
Human Rights Watch and the Israeli group B'Tselem came to identical conclusions. Yet, despite this, you know, there's been real opposition in the United States. In fact, just yesterday, the House of Representatives voted on a 344-36 vote to condemn the Goldstone report. And say it was irredeemably biased, and not only should the Obama administration block any endorsement of the report, but should block any consideration of the report, not even looking at it.
Now, did I miss something? Did Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones drop by the House and neuralize them before they took this vote? That's a joke from Men in Black, where they had these little gizmos that could cause amnesia from anybody who saw this bright light that they were able to flash. And I'm sorry, what we're hearing is an effort to rewrite history and to escape from reality, Stephen.
Oh, very, very, very much so. I mean, here's the report, black and white in front of them. And here they had 70 pages, you know, looking at 70 pages looking at the what they referred to as war crimes and possible crimes against humanity by Hamas in shelling Israeli targets, and yet this resolution says that the report, quote, makes no mention of the relentless rocket and mortar attacks by Hamas. I mean, none of them bothered to read it. They just ended up blasting the report. And what's frightening to me is that if Goldstone, who you know, who not only is a as we've mentioned, one of the most respected authorities of international humanitarian law in the world, but is also a Zionist Jew, head of the board of the Friends of Hebrew University, president emeritus of the World Jewish Ort Schools, his daughter is an Israeli citizen. I mean, if this is if even he is accused of anti-Israel bias, I think it's indicative that the House of Representatives is not even interested in even considering that perhaps a U.S. ally might engage in war crimes.
Well, and the talking point that appears to be most commonly used here is that the report is deeply flawed. But that's never explained or detailed about exactly why they consider it so deeply flawed. And it appears, again, that they don't like the result. They don't like to see the issues presented in black and white, because when they are, Israel suffers, and it basically contradicts the spin that Israel used, that this was a defensive effort, that this was a preemptive. I mean, a lot of this is based on the failed doctrine of George W. Bush. But they were embracing American talking points by saying that, well, we were forced to do this to protect ourselves from future attacks.
And even putting aside the question of whether Israel should or should not use force against Hamas as a means of stopping the rocket attacks, particularly when Hamas offered to negotiate to stop the attacks in return for lifting the siege and other things. But even putting that whole question aside, the fact is, no matter how justified you may be in fighting a war, that still doesn't give you the right to attack civilians. The vast majority of those 1,400 people killed were innocent civilians. They were in schools and mosques and homes, nowhere near military operations in many cases. The House of Representatives has gone on record, both in this resolution, the resolution yesterday, and one back in January, insisting that Hamas used human shields. Yet the Goldstone Report, as well as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, all those have investigated the claims of human shields. Hey, they have not found a single case of that, where Hamas can deliberately put civilians in danger as a kind of deterrent.
And Stephen, let me pause here for a moment, because I think it's really important to understand the brutality imposed by Israel on the largely defenseless population in Gaza. And that of the 1,400 Palestinians who were killed, more than half of those were women and children.
Yes.
So if, and this plays into this phony issue of human shields, Israel knew that it was using tanks, bulldozers, aerial assaults, helicopters,
phosphorus bombs that are illegal for using in these kind of situations,
as well as cluster bombs, mm-hmm. and they were using these in heavily, densely populated areas, residential areas.
Yeah.
And let me tell you one quick story. I was in touch during this siege with a man named Sami, S-A-M-E-H, Sami Habib. And he made himself available to Western news outlets around the clock. And so I called him, and I recall it was about 3 o'clock Pacific time, so it was roughly midnight or a little later in Gaza at that time. And he said, listen. And he held his phone up to the window, and I could hear an Israeli tank rumbling by, and seconds later, it fired a shell. Now, this is in pitch darkness in a residential area. Mm-hmm. And so not only is this human shield claim a canard and an obscene one at that, but Israel took certain military actions with full knowledge that innocent civilians were within range of direct or indirect fire that they were initiating.
Exactly. And this is, again, this has been confirmed by numerous reports. And yet the majority of Congress, and this is not just Republicans, we're talking about, the chief sponsors of this resolution were Howard Berman, the Democratic head of the House Foreign Relations Committee, along with Gary Ackerman, the Democratic head of the Subcommittee on the Middle East. Other co-sponsors included Steny Hoyer, the majority leader, and the resolution back in January, defending the Israeli attacks and making these false claims of human shields.
Mm-hmm.
Chief sponsor of that was Nancy Pelosi. It's indicative that the Republicans I think one of the big, one of the frightening legacies of the Bush foreign policy is this idea that that the United States can just reject international humanitarian law, that we can deny reality. If the facts are inconvenient, we can ignore the facts. And the Democrats have adopted this by a huge margin. 80% of them voted in favor of this. It really boggles the mind. It really does. I mean, one can certainly disagree on a whole number of things. Reasonable people can disagree on the Middle East and mm-hmm. various parties' responsibilities. But for a report to recognize correctly that there are war crimes committed on both sides, and then for virtually the entire House of Representatives go on record denouncing those findings, I think shows there's a serious problem with our political system. Well, I really don't think a majority of Americans support denying reality like that.
Well, and Stephen, it also shows hypocrisy and something that I'm really disappointed in President Obama, because I was pleased that, in the first week or two of his administration, he made it clear that he wanted to work on the Israel-Palestine issues, not as a legacy matter toward the end of his term, but as something that is front and center. and he appointed George Mitchell. And these were encouraging signs to say, okay, this is a high priority, and Obama is going to reposition the United States as more of, and I don't have any real illusions in an ideal zone, but as more of an honest broker between these disaffected parties. But what we're seeing is that that's a charade. And let's talk now about the comments coming from UN Ambassador Susan Rice and P.J. Crowley over at the State Department. Now, I've interviewed both of these people. Rice impressed me, first of all, because she's not Condoleezza Rice. But I got a sense that she was well-informed and somebody who was prepared to use positive diplomacy to try to repair America's reputation. And P.J. Crowley was over at the Center for American Progress until he came into the Clinton State Department and was a very sharp critic of the Bush administration on many valid points. And they're spouting the Obama talking point here that, well, we want to move forward. We don't want to look backward. And I'm sorry, this is just a crock of shit.
Yeah.
Because you cannot resolve these long-term and deep problems between Israel and the Palestinians with photo ops and press releases, while the actions that we take are to undermine any credible, objective approach to the very recent past. It's not as if we're talking about 1948 here.
Right. In fact, it's interesting that Ambassador Rice, just a few weeks before, she said, focus on the past. We need to look at the future, we can't do anything that might interfere with the peace process. She was arguing just the opposite. I mean, just the opposite regarding the war crimes charges against the Sudanese leaders in Darfur.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying, people were saying, this might crack down and make things worse and whatever. And she said, no, that international law is international law. War crimes are war crimes, and these things need to be in. Those guilty need to be held accountable. And so she's flipped on this when it comes to a U.S. ally.
And you quote Crowley saying that the Goldstone Report should not be used as a mechanism to add impediments to getting back to the peace process. I would say that 1,400 recently slaughtered Palestinians are a major impediment to the so-called peace process.
Very much so. And I mean, if you can't even hold people accountable for war crimes, I mean, there's no hope for reconciliation. This is true with both sides.
So, Stephen, it does appear that the U.S. and Israel are going to be able to prevent the Goldstone Report that came out of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations from ever being brought before the Security Council. Is that the strategy here?
That seems to be what it's about, because basically what the Goldstone Report said is that if the Israelis and the Palestinians refuse to prosecute and investigate possible war crimes and prosecute those responsible, that it should be passed to the International Criminal Court for possible indictment. And since neither Hamas nor Israel have signed the ICC protocol, that means it has to go to the UN Security Council. But the United States doesn't want that to happen. In fact, the resolution yesterday said, Israel has is thoroughly investigating. They got a democracy, good judiciary system, et cetera. So this can't happen. Well, if they really have confidence in Israel's judiciary system, they don't have to worry, because the ICC has never, ever indicted anyone from a country where war crimes were thoroughly investigated and they took care of it themselves. So clearly what Congress is trying to do here is to let these war criminals get off scot-free. And that's what the Obama administration seems to be pushing as well, that not only putting the fact that Israel has not launched an independent investigation, that despite all the evidence, including testimony of Israeli soldiers themselves, the only indictments that Israel has handed down to soldiers were to a couple of soldiers who stole somebody's credit card during a raid.
Mm-hmm.
For the mass killings of civilians. So by by blocking at the United Nations, basically what that is doing is making sure that these people aren't brought to justice. The question is, how much will other countries push this? Will it force the Obama administration to cast its first veto? And can you imagine the international community's reaction that after all this hope of Barack Obama, that unlike the Bush administration, that he actually cares about international law, that he would actually veto a recommendation that simply says, you know, war criminals should be brought to justice if their own court systems will not follow through on this. This is going to alienate a lot of people who really had hoped better of America.
And Stephen, let me quote here the last two paragraphs of your article at Foreign Policy in Focus, because I think they're lucid and quite persuasive. This latest assault against the human rights community by the Obama administration and congressional Democrats is not an example of their being too pro-Israel. Indeed, such war crimes and other gross and systematic human rights abuses by the Israeli government endanger Israel's security and have led to the rise of extremist groups such as Hamas and Hezbollah in the first place. Unfortunately, the Democratic leadership in Washington has joined the Republicans in a campaign, in effect, to kill the messenger, attack the United Nations, Amnesty International, or anyone else, be they journalist, scholar, activist, or even one of the world's most respected jurists, who dares put forward credible evidence of human rights abuses by the United States or its allies. And then you quote Goldstone, "A culture of impunity in the region has existed for too long. The lack of accountability for war crimes and possible war crimes against humanity has reached a crisis point," end quote. And your last line, "The Obama administration and the Democratic leadership in Congress are part of this problem, not part of the solution." And I would only amplify, Stephen, that this can only help cement the perception that the United States will always back Israel and that it cannot ever move into a position where it would be fair to those who are opposed to Israel or declared its enemies by Israel.
Yeah, very much so. The ramifications of this are very very disappointing, to say the least. And I think it really underscores that. I really hope that your listeners will check to see how their member of the House voted on the resolution yesterday and hear from them, because this is about a lot more than Israel-Palestine. This is about human rights and international law. This is whether people can kill civilians in large numbers with impunity or not. I mean, we're supposed to be one would think 60 years after the International Declaration of Human Rights, and even more than that, after the horrors of World War II, that mass killing of civilians would be recognized as something that should not be defended.
Yeah.
And yet, that's exactly what Congress did yesterday.
And, Stephen, in a moment, I want to talk about Secretary Clinton's comments in Pakistan, where she repeatedly dodged questions regarding the human rights aspects of our use of military drones. But I want to stay with the Middle East for a moment here, because Secretary Clinton left Pakistan and went to the Middle East and then to Egypt on the current trip that she embarked on. And she tried to get the Palestinians to come back to the table with the Israelis because the Israelis made a minor concession regarding the expansion of settlements on Palestinian territory. And this, again, just flies in the face of anyone who is even close to objective and who looks at this and says that here is the United States saying, our friend Israel has made a concession here. It's virtually meaningless, but hey, it's a concession. And so we want you to, basically defy the will of your people, come back to the table, be prepared to recognize Israel and withdraw the comments from the past, regarding its right to exist. And anybody who thinks that this is a path forward to peace is coming from another planet, Stephen.
Yeah. I mean, what's amazing is virtually every Arab country is on record as a result of the Arab League votes on the Arab peace proposal, that they will recognize Israel's right to exist, that they will have strict security guarantees, et cetera, if Israel ends the occupation. And they cannot end the occupation if they continue colonizing occupied land and transferring your civilian population onto such land seized by military force is a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. In the specific case of the Israeli settlements, has been declared illegal in a near-unanimous decision of the International Court of Justice, as well as no less than five UN Security Council resolutions. In other words, every single settlement Israel is required by law to withdraw from. Now, all the Obama administration has been asking is just don't build new ones.
Right.
Don't build any more. And Israel's not even doing that. They're just saying that we will slow down the pace of new settlements for a few months. And yet, as limited as that is, they get the praise of Hillary Clinton. Now, let's remember, Hillary Clinton, as a senator, visited settlements, had photo ops of the settlements, defended the settlements, was the chief sponsor of a resolution blasting the International Court of Justice for pointing out that they were illegal. She's always taken a very, very hard line on it. So in certain ways, this isn't surprising. But at least the president she's supposedly working for had given some indication that he was actually going to take somewhat of a tougher line.
Well, and again, it's contradictory and counterproductive, and it suggests that they think that they can fake their way to peace talks. And I just am one who believes that the Palestinians have been under duress for so long that they're not willing to compromise. They know that they have to fight for everything, because whatever deals are struck are likely. I mean, I'm speaking hypothetically here, but my perception is that they're likely to be beneficial to Israel. And so it just makes no sense for them to make concessions at this point in ways that would separate the leadership from their own people.
Yeah, very much so. And let's remember, they've already made incredible compromises by basically saying Israel can control 72% of Palestine. I mean, that's what was agreed to in the Oslo Accords. So the peace process now is the fate of the remaining 78% of Palestine. The discussions right now are what to do with the remaining 22%. And the Israeli position is 22% is too much for the Palestinians. They should accept less than that, and in a way that is divided up in these tiny non-contiguous cantons surrounded by these Israeli settlement blocks that we can control. We control and that you have to go through our checkpoints to go from one part of your country to another.
Mm-hmm.
This plan was endorsed by President Bush and by Congress. And again, it looks like Obama might be raising questions about the practicality of that. But he has also said that under no circumstances would he consider using aid as a leverage to pressure Israel. And he certainly seems to not be taking any real clear means of pressing the Israelis to live up to their international responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very discouraging. Read Stephen Zuna's piece at Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org, about the Goldstone Report. And Stephen, I wanted to now move on to Pakistan, where Secretary Clinton made a visit, and there were some remarkable public meetings that she held. On the record with cameras rolling. And I was struck by a Pakistani female student who pressed Secretary Clinton regarding the use of unmanned drones that are routinely flown into areas of Pakistan, and they unleash missiles that kill a target and sometimes kill civilians. And I thought this woman was very courageous in confronting the secretary about this. She asked a question that I have not heard come from any member of the United States media or any member of our Congress. And she equated the use of these drones to trial and, or I'm sorry, to execution without trial, and said this is terrorism. And what was fascinating is it's very clear that Clinton had rehearsed her non-response to such a question, because she didn't even acknowledge that drones exist and are being flown over Pakistan. She basically just said, well, there's a war on. And that was the extent of her answer. And I think that, you know, again, the American media should be pressing these points to the Obama administration. What is the basis for the use of these drones? What international law are you utilizing to rationalize this this assault on a sovereign nation? And, you know, what human rights standard do you use to rationalize that it's okay to try to take out a Taliban or an Al-Qaeda leader in this manner? Because what? Because we don't have to commit American forces to do it? Because we don't have to go through a messy process of jurisprudence to determine who's guilty and who should be punished? I mean, we are playing fast and loose with any kind of standards that used to exist. And the idea that Obama is better than Bush on these issues is proving simply to be untrue.
Yeah, it's a tricky issue. I mean, there are those, of course, that argue that you know, these people are in these you know, remote areas that is logistically difficult to come to and get to, and these people are the, you know, worst of the worst, you know, terrorists, and and, you know, and if we can, you know, cough the heads of the organization, you know, maybe that will, you know, be less likely that they'll be able to coordinate, you know, possible terrorist attacks and the like. The problem, of course, is, as you outline, is that there really is no legal basis for these assassinations. And, you know, probably the biggest problem is that while the, you know, missiles themselves are usually reasonably accurate, the intelligence isn't also always that accurate. And you do end up, you know, killing civilians, often in large numbers. And in a tribal society, you know, where, you know, people if you are duty-bound to take revenge if someone takes the life of a relative, in many ways this appears to be, you know, creating terrorists and extremists faster than it can kill them. So there are some very, on one hand, one could see, you know, perhaps some of the logic, you know, behind it in practice, and certainly legally, it raises a lot of very serious questions.
Well, and again, it appears that we don't feel that we're required to answer those questions.
No, and that's what really disturbed me about her non-response. That that you can't just say, oh, there's a war, because there are laws of war, and as of course the topic of earlier in our conversation indicated, the U.S. government doesn't really care that much about the laws of war. Still, at least for appearance's sake, you would think that she would try to give a better answer than she did.
Yeah. Well, it's it's very discouraging to see this first year of the Obama administration repeat and extend some of the worst moves of the Bush administration. And while I'll applaud the president for trying to close Guantanamo and not getting full support even from members of his own party, we still have a huge detention center at Bagram that operates under Gitmo rules. And so we have not escaped from the lawlessness and the unconstitutional behavior of the prior administration. And this whole mantra of looking forward, not backward, is so insulting. And it demeans any attempt to separate ourselves from the barbarism of the recent past. And as we, let me just in closing get your comments on Afghanistan, where this week Abdullah Squared bowed out of a runoff, and that leaves Karzai standing. It doesn't make him any more credible. It doesn't make him less corrupt. It doesn't mean that there really is a functioning central government in Afghanistan. The army and police there are riddled with Taliban infiltration. And yet our generals tell us that we can train up the Afghans and in relatively short order that they can take responsibility for their country. And I'm very concerned that Obama will approve additional troops to Afghanistan and sentence us to another 5 or 10 years that can only end badly.
Yeah, it's interesting that his own national security advisor, James Jones, acknowledged that there were at most maybe 100 Al-Qaeda fighters, 100 Al-Qaeda operatives left in Afghanistan. They had no base. They were not capable of striking the United States or its allies. I mean, they're probably more Al-Qaeda operatives than the United States and other Western countries.
Mm-hmm.
So it raises the question, why are we there? Why are we fighting? One could say, well, maybe we have to defend the legitimate democratic government of Afghanistan. But if it's a government that steals elections, is closely tied to the drug trade, which is riddled with corruption, has mm-hmm. little credibility within its with its own people, it raises questions why we are sacrificing the lives and money and prestige for that either. I'm having a harder and I'm one who believes that at least some targeted military response was justified in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, given the nature of the threat of Al-Qaeda. But the idea that we can bombing this country that's already impoverished, war ravaged, and a continuing a counterinsurgency war there, I really cannot see the logic anymore. I really cannot.
Yeah. Well, mission creep doesn't even apply because the original mission, I didn't completely support it, but it was the kind of thing that was hard to oppose because we were looking for some way to respond and to show people that we weren't going to take this lying down. But because I don't believe the official story of 9/11, it makes it hard to rationalize a response because I don't think we know the truth about how it happened and who ultimately was responsible. And so that leaves me in a gray zone that's hard to legitimize even the original assault there to take out Al-Qaeda. That said, you're correct that there's nothing remotely resembling the original mission on the landscape of Afghanistan today. And to bog down what could become 100,000 American troops, plus all those contractors that come with them, could make it very difficult for us to respond to a provocation from Iran, from Pakistan, from India. And that's where I have grave concerns, and I feel that nobody's really listening. We are at least having some semblance of a debate about this, but it doesn't seem that rational thinking will prevail, Stephen.
I'm afraid you're right. I'm afraid you're right.
Well, thank you for your time today. As always, I enjoy talking with you. And Stephen Zunis, professor of politics, University of San Francisco. And you can also read his work at fpif.org, Foreign Policy in Focus. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Still to come on the Peter B. Collins Show, an exclusive report from our in-depth undercover low-budget investigative reporter, Tommy Panic. He's been undercover. That's why we haven't heard from him recently. His report straight ahead here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just go to my homepage at peterbcollins.com and click on the link there for a special introductory offer for you from the Organic Wine Company. Little transition music from The Clash. If you're an HBO subscriber, there's a cool new documentary out about the late Joe Strummer. Check it out.
The
Joining me now is David DeGraw, and he wants to introduce you to a website called ampedstatus.com. I recently learned about it, and I've been monitoring it over the last few weeks. David DeGraw, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Hey, Peter, how you doing? Great to be here. I've long respected your work. You do a great job over there.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for having me on. But the point here is I'm not here to talk about a website. You know, I'm here to talk about a national emergency.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, well, first, let's set people up, though, because I want them to be able to get the information that you've compiled. And give us a little background. What caused you to put the AMPED Status website together?
Well, I've been working for MediaChannel.org for about 5 years now. It's a media criticism site.
Those are my friends Danny Schechter and Rory O'Connor in the
exactly,
gang.
Exactly. I work with them on a daily basis. And I've been paying real close attention to the news. You know, I spend about 12 hours a day, maybe 6 days a week, analyzing the news. Kind of a torturous process. But having seen recent news, not that it, you know, hasn't been bad for a while, but having seen recent news, I came to the understanding that we are, in fact, in a national emergency.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have a crisis on our hands bigger than we have ever seen as a nation before.
Well, and the crime you're talking about is still in progress, and the suspects, actually the perpetrators, are all in plain sight, and they wear really nice suits and drive fancy cars.
yes, they do. I mean, we live in a country where 1% of the population controls 75% of the wealth. That leaves 99% of the U.S. population to fight over 25% of the wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as in keeping a close eye on the news, I've come across some very revealing statistics and facts that Americans, I mean, honestly, we need to start spreading the word about this and getting this information out because, I mean, this is devastating numbers. I mean, if I can share with you some of these stats.
Go right ahead.
They're very telling indicators, okay? You have 25 million Americans who are either unemployed or underemployed.
Mm-hmm.
That's 25 million people who urgently need to increase their income, and they're running out of options. On top of that, you have 50 million American citizens who are living in poverty, okay? On top of that, and this is just a horrific stat that just came out yesterday, 1 out of every 2 children in the United States will eat using a food stamp. 50% of U.S. children will use a food stamp to get food. I mean, this is a national tragedy. There's no way this should be happening in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
With the wealth we have, with the wealth that was stolen from the U.S. taxpayers, courtesy of Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner, this is obscene.
Now, did you happen to see, David, it was during July, the public television news hour videotaped a town hall meeting in Kansas City with Fed Chairman Bernanke. And, you know, people were allowed to ask questions, but it was carefully orchestrated and I thought, heavily edited. And they permitted him to come on the news hour for 20 minutes at a pop 3 nights in a row and presented this as if this is your accessible, expansive Fed chairman who is sitting down with the real people to explain to them what has occurred. And what Bernanke did was talk exclusively about the $700 billion TARP money that Congress appropriated under an election deadline threat from the Bush administration. It wasn't the first time that Bush pulled this one off, but it was a big heist at the end of his second term. And he managed to essentially corral Nancy Pelosi into doing the dirty work that his Republican leaders would not do on Capitol Hill. But when we look at this, we see that at the peak, something like $16 trillion of American money and credit was extended to bail out the banks.
Where did that money go?
Well, they don't even know. If you ask Elizabeth Warren, whose charge is simply to monitor the $700 billion of the TARP money, she can't even tell you where that money is. But the $13 trillion that remains out there is extended on our behalf to bail out the financiers who drove us over a cliff and who use derivatives and these credit swaps and the insurance bets on both sides of those investment gambles to run very high risks at extreme leverage. And now we are going to socialize those losses, and we're not even being honest with those who are paying the freight about the extent to which we have committed our funds.
Right. McClatchy just had a great investigation into Goldman Sachs and what basically was their subprime scams of billions of dollars. I mean, the theft that has gone on with public wealth, with taxpayer money, is unprecedented. This is simply the greatest threat in the history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, I feel as if, and I believe the facts bear this out, the Bush administration, once they got into office, Bush and Cheney, waged a war against the U.S. middle class. That was they wanted to leave office having devastated the U.S. middle class. And they did a great job of it because the last, final, ultimate act of the Bush administration was to bring Hank Paulson into the Treasury and steal trillions of our money.
David, the terms you use here, I think, are accurate and advisable because, for example, you know, most people look at this and they say, well, you know, it's just business as usual. It's the way government works.
I understand there's always corruption in politics and human nature. I understand that. But this is literally, I mean, the facts are there. I mean, anyone listening to this conversation right now, call up your representative. Call them up and say, you know, you're my representative. I want to know what happened to trillions of dollars, of my dollars, of taxpayer dollars. I want to know what happened to it. And see what your representative tells you. You'll be entertained by it. I mean, if you're normally apathetic and you just want to be entertained, call up your congressman and ask them where trillions of dollars went. Because you're going to be very entertained by what they tell you.
Well, and you describe this as an economic coup. Explain what you mean, David.
Oh, what I mean is trillions of taxpayer dollars have vanished, gone. Where did it go? Nobody knows. Ask your congressman, where did it go? They don't know. I mean, this is the greatest theft of public wealth. And every American should be insulted. This is the money that comes out of your paycheck every week. This is your hard-earned money that is being taken away from you and your family. You're sitting out there, you're struggling to pay your bills, and that big chunk of your check that disappears is going into the pockets of Goldman Sachs. It's going into the pockets of Lloyd Blankfein, of Jamie Dimon. These are real people that have our money. That's what people need to understand, okay? When people see bonuses, they might make the connection and say, wow, he got a $10 million bonus, an annual $10 million bonus. And that's more money than I'll make in my entire life. And they think, wow, that's just not right. And aren't these the people who caused the crash? That's not right. But the connection that I think most people aren't making is that money is your money that comes out of your paycheck. That's your money that Lloyd Blankfein has, Jamie Dimon. Those bonuses, $140 or $160 billion in profits.
Well, I think the bonus pool is about $140 billion for this year. Am I correct on that?
I believe you're correct, yes.
Yeah. And this, of course, occurred at a time when our money was propping up these companies, and Citigroup, Citicorp, is the most prominent example, because we should have nationalized that firm. At the time they put federal dollars in to prop it up, we put in more money than the market cap of Citicorp. Right. And we should have bought it and taken control. And as we see right now, the British government did that with the Royal Bank of Scotland and what's called Northern Rock. And those banks are now being broken up into smaller companies and reprivatized. And that is the process that we should have embarked on a year ago, allowing the bankruptcy process to work its course and to force these people to absorb the losses that they created.
Peter, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I think that it pollutes what has happened when we talk about what we should have done. We need to talk about what was done, okay? Because people need to understand, first and foremost, that our money has been stolen. The rise in the stock market is because our money is being used to pump it up. The record-breaking profits at Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, that's our tax money. And they are flaunting it in our face, $160 billion. These are the richest people on the planet giving themselves huge bonuses. That's our money. That money, just a small fraction of that money, could be used to provide the highest quality of health care to everyone in this country.
Mm-hmm.
This is a crime against humanity. People need to start understanding this, okay? Now, when I gave you those stats at the beginning of the conversation, 50 million people living in poverty and desperate, there's another indicator, okay? Another very telling indicator, the huge gun manufacturing base in the United States. The gun industry is huge, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The manufacturing base cannot produce enough ammunition to fulfill demand. Americans are arming themselves to the teeth. They can't make enough bullets. Do you understand how big the gun industry is and how much of a manufacturing base they have?
Mm-hmm.
They can't make enough bullets. And these people are desperate for money, for income, for any hope. These people, they're stressed out. They probably have bad health. They can't get health insurance. They can't afford to get health care. I mean, this is a powder keg we're sitting on.
So,
this is a national emergency, and we need some kind of leadership. Obama, it looks like he's not going to be the answer. Sad to say, but this man, his actions do not follow his words. If you look at the facts, look at the legal documents that Barack Obama has signed. Look at his signature on those documents. They are, for the most part, opposite of what he says. Obama is in the White House for three reasons, okay? One, millions came out and supported him. People who knew that we needed change came out and supported him and donated time that they didn't have, they couldn't afford, because they wanted him in, because what he said was what they needed to hear. Okay? That's one constituency. The other two are Goldman Sachs and the health insurance industry. Goldman Sachs saw Obama and said, "That's our guy. That's the guy we're going to finance his campaign." They financed his campaign.
Yeah, they had the early money for sure. The Goldman Sachs bundling was very important in the period between Iowa and April, which is really when Obama's direct internet fundraising started to kick in. But that early money, and I also want to identify that the early support from for Obama was from those of us who felt he had the clearest position in opposition to the war in Iraq. And he has since modulated that quite a bit. After all, no significant reduction of U.S. troops in Iraq has occurred
in the time since he took the... 68 billion to the military budget, added to Bush's budget.
Mm-hmm.
68. so old school. This is billions.
Right.
$68 billion he added to Bush's military budget. He has literally gone out of his way to cover up everything the Bush administration has done. And they have done a lot. I mean, they're the most illegal administration in the history of the United States, as far as I can tell. I mean, maybe some historian can argue with me on that. Highly illegal things they have done. And the Obama administration has time and time again. Obama has signed his name to documents covering up what they have done.
Mm-hmm.
Forget his words. His words are great. I hear his words, and I want to, you know, stand up and cheer. Forget his words.
Now, David, let's focus here on what steps you think people should be taking to deal with these financiopaths. That's a term that was coined for Charlie Keating back during the savings and loan scandals of the 1980s.
And who was involved in the savings and loan scandal? Same people. Mm-hmm. Bush Sr. I mean, the Bush family. Neil Bush was the poster boy for the savings and loan scandal.
Silverado savings and loan, $1.5 billion in Colorado.
Mm-hmm. All the same characters, all the same people. Look at the history of it.
David, for me, one of the critical factors here is that Timothy Geithner is just Hank Paulson with a different face.
Yeah,
and
that, I mean, to me, when Obama was elected, I was like, wow, this is going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. He's speaking for the people, yet he's financed by Goldman Sachs. I mean, how is that going to work? Well, one of the first things he did as president was put Timothy Geithner in charge of the U.S. Treasury. I mean, Geithner and Paulson were in constant contact during the financial crisis when all these trillions of dollars disappeared, okay? They're both Goldman Sachs guys, and they're like the Goldman Sachs wonder twins, Paulson and Geithner. I mean, it's obscene. And, you know, and Obama puts them in office, I mean, in the Treasury.
Mm-hmm. So should we be agitating to get Timothy Geithner out as Secretary of Treasury?
Right,
is that a place to start?
Back to the point of your question. Sorry, I went off on a tangent there. But what we need to do, in my opinion, you know, I've given a lot of thought, and, you know, I don't have a magic bullet or anything. But in my opinion, everyone who's listening to this show needs to call their congressperson. You need to call your representative, and you just ask them, where is all this money? Explain to your representative all your troubles. Are you having troubles paying your bills? Tell it to your representative. Get them and make them understand the situation you're in. Because I think that's the most important strategic imperative for us, okay? Because the executive branch has been bought and sold. The judicial branch, for the most part, not completely, but for the most part, has been bought and sold. The Senate, again, for the most part, bought and sold.
Mm-hmm.
The best chance we have of making change is for us to get down to our representatives in the House and start raising hell. We need to get in touch with our representatives and just communicate with them. Just communicate with them. Tell them your problems. Tell them you want to know where all the tax money is going that's in your check every week. Tell them you want answers. I mean, what kind of representative can't tell you where a huge chunk of your tax money is going? They don't know where it went. It disappeared. It went into Hank Paulson's magical vault. I mean, I'm sorry, you know, to get all worked up like this, but I'm telling you, I've been paying attention to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the facts on the ground.
Right.
We are sitting on a powder keg here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just take your point, and I don't disagree with you, David. I think people should communicate with their members of Congress. The problem is that a lot of them are blocked in various ways or compromised as well because they're addicted to the campaign finance system. And the banks and insurance companies and the Wall Street interests have been funneling now our money out as campaign contributions. And so we do have a fairly obscene mess where the people who we look to to represent us, to protect our money, and to preserve our government, are in cahoots with the people who fleeced it. And
I like to tell people they're on the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're on the payroll. The richest 1% has most of our political representatives on their payroll. That's what Americans need to understand. And look, I know that it's not a great option going to your representative in the House. But I mean, we're running out of options here. I mean, what's the option after, you know, if you give up on the House, then what do you have?
Well, I think that, again, focusing on Geithner and trying to get the message across to Obama that he has blundered and really separated himself from his political base by embracing Wall Street and the plutocrats in this country, and that we need to... He also is confronting the specter that Republicans, as disingenuous as it is, will attempt to tag him with complete responsibility for the bailouts and for the crisis that preceded the bailouts, and turn this into a winning political issue either next year in the midterm elections of 2010 or in the presidential and other elections in 2012.
Right. I mean, that's why this Obama situation is such a tragedy. I mean, people just don't know where to turn. I mean, do you think Obama made a blunder by putting Geithner in there, or do you think he knew what he was doing?
Oh, I think he chose continuity, and I think that he was persuaded by...
That is intense continuity right there.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
But, and I use the term advisedly because he was the candidate of change, and I do consider it to be hypocritical, if not contradictory, of him to sell us change and give us continuity in the form of Robert Gates at the Defense Department and the continuation of the failed Bush policies with just a slightly different PR twist on them. And likewise, you know, with our finance system, he embraced Geithner for the continuity with Paulson and essentially, you know, has swallowed the bullshit. And it's hard for me to tell whether he is a cynic who took their money and will say anything, do anything to serve those interests, or if he just feels trapped that, you know, he didn't want to see the system melt down even further, and so he felt the only way to go was to further empower the people who had wrecked it. Now, that doesn't make sense to me, but it's my effort.
If that is the case, the argument here is he completely naive and inept as a political strategist, or is he part of the problem?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
well, David,
his words
David,
and his
this,
actions don't seem to match up.
This leads to a different conversation, but I'm going to start it with you as we get ready to wrap up here.
Sure.
And that is, on so many issues that we've ticked off here, the domestic wiretapping, the torture policies, the closure of Guantanamo, the continuation of the Guantanamo policies at Bagram in Afghanistan, the expansion of U.S. Military presence in Afghanistan, and the continuation of a war that has no prospect whatsoever of a good outcome for the United States. When we look at all of these and the failure on health care, where they started by squeezing out the single-payer advocates and then were left with nothing to negotiate over, well, I see...
Let's not forget the huge elephant in the room of trillions of dollars of taxpayer money that
right. No,
vanished.
That's already part of our conversation. So what I'm saying is that on these factors, it is time for a principled, progressive Democrat to start sounding the alarm and testing the waters to challenge Absolutely. Obama in the primaries of 2012. We cannot sit back and just say, oh, well, he's not Bush, and, you know, we don't have Cheney anymore. You know, that's not good enough. We really have to look at the need to challenge Obama from his left, either as a way of getting him to move in the left direction, in the correct direction, or that we need to show him that we're serious about replacing him in 2012 if he is, you know, if he continues to fail to deliver on the critical promises that he made to us.
Peter, I don't like to use labels and terms such as the left and the right, okay? I try and boil it down for people, all right? It's the richest 1%, and it's 99% of the American public, okay? That's to me, that is the war that's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
The richest 1% have declared war on 99% of the U.S. population. I mean, that's just the facts of the matter. Look at the economic indicators. Look at the numbers. Look at the facts.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, I want to thank you for joining me today, and I appreciate your passion. I think you are a great American who is sounding an important alarm. And I want people to visit your website, ampedstatus.com, and we'll have the link on the podcast information at peterbcollins.com. Thanks for joining me, David DeGraw.
All right, thank you, Peter. I really appreciate having me on, and keep up the fight, Peter, because this is a serious situation. Americans need to take action, because this is no longer a political abstraction. This is coming to your doorstep. This is your pay. This is the economy. We need to start acting now. Call your representative. The House. Bring the fight to the House. That's my message.
And now, here on the Peter B. Collins Show, the return of Tommy Panic. He is our in-depth, undercover, low-budget investigative reporter. And he's been missing in action for some time now. My friend Benny, who monitors me over at the NSA, occasionally will cough up some information. So I asked him, where's Panic? And Benny required about 14 seconds. And he said, inside the Beltway. And then cryptically he said, wearing stripes. Now, Tommy's a California casual kind of guy. I don't think those are pinstripes. Let's find out more. Tommy Panic joins us now. Tommy, DC and stripes, can you explain?
Well, you might initially think I was incarcerated or something like that in our nation's capital. Not the case. Not the case, Peter. Great to be with you, by the way.
Well, and good, too, because my bail bond budget is expired.
Well, it's good thing I've stayed out of trouble then. I mean, as you know, my undercover work takes me all over the world, certainly all over the country. But I have been in D.C. for several months now. I've secured a regular gig, undercover, of course, as a referee for the president's White House basketball games.
Oh, the hoops right there at the White House.
Yeah, right on the South Lawn there. The president likes to win. To the point that he stacks the deck in his favor. I mean, a lot of people, different ideologies, donkeys, elephants, a lot of people have reasons they don't like the president. But for me, this is the reason. If you want a reason not to like the president, this is it. I mean, have you seen some of the guys that join the regular game there at the White House?
Yeah, some of them, and some of them are white guys who can't jump.
Well, they're not just white, they're ancient. I mean, we're talking about Michael R. Curie, the 50-year-old Democrat from New York. How about Jay Inslee, 58 years old, a Democrat from Washington. Barron Hill, 56 years old. I mean, it is like a ruptured Achilles waiting to happen. Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, 48 years old. He's out there playing. Every time he shoots, people yell, pay your taxes. Ken Salazar, what is he, our Interior Secretary?
Yeah, the bolo tie guy.
Yeah, 54 years old. I mean, Peter, should your tax dollars really have to go towards rehabilitating some middle-aged white guy's torn ACL?
Well, maybe they're trying to make the case for health care reform.
Maybe, but I mean, and the obvious question is, why no elephants? Where are the Republicans? It's a fair question. There's a couple guys from the right that play, but honestly, it's a little tough for the president to find any of those types that aren't morbidly obese, which really, get them out there, get them running around, seems like a good way to thin the ranks on that side of the aisle. You get it? Thin.
Yeah, thin out the herd.
Now, there's been some talk, this is interesting, a lot of women's groups have discussed the fact that there are no women that are part of this game.
Mm.
And we did a little investigating on that. Apparently, President Obama has thrown out some invitations, a couple of 76-year-olds, Dianne Feinstein and Ruth Bader Ginsburg have been invited.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Helen Thomas, what is she, 89? She has been invited to play. No word as to whether or not they will play, But President Obama likes playing basketball with old white men. It's a weird thing, but I hope my appearance here on the Peter B. Collins show does not jeopardize my work as a referee there. You never know.
Yeah, and be careful, too. Now, we can offer that there's a second source for this, Tommy, so that you're not isolated here and outed. Because CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, won a victory against the White House recently, and all the visitors' logs are now available for public inspection. I don't know if they designate who comes to the White House for hoops and who comes for health care or, bucking up the troops in Afghanistan, but the raw data is available there.
Okay, very, very good. So I'm not left out on an island. I'll probably be able to keep this gig. But before I got going with this, I was traveling around the country, and you know that I spent a lot of time up there in our 49th state, following the Palins around. Went out a couple of times on wolf hunts from a helicopter, which was fun.
Mm-hmm.
And most recently, I've been tailing Levi Johnston. You know who I'm talking about, the guy.
Oh, I sure do.
Of Bristol Palin.
And I may actually buy Playgirl just to see what he's exposing there.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I've been commissioned to go undercover for the Levi Johnston Playgirl shoot. Even Tommy Panic, though, has limits. I don't know if I'm even going to do that, but I did work as a gaffer, or you know what? I might have been a grip. I'm not sure. I worked on the shoot for his appearance in those pistachio commercials. I don't know if you've seen those.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, he does an ad for the pistachio. Nothing screams nuts quite like the kid who knocked up the abstinence preaching former governor of Cold there.
Yeah, you're right about that.
You know, the lady whose breasts John McCain couldn't take his eyes off about a year ago. But I will probably not be doing even. I don't want to sit and look at that guy naked. That's mm-hmm. kind of what it comes down to. I don't know. I don't need to be in the room for that.
I'm with you there. And also, while it's interesting that he's telling tales from the Palin household, hearing her call her baby with Down syndrome my retard, I don't think that helps anybody.
No. No, certainly not the baby.
Yeah.
Certainly not. How could that help her politically? No, not at all. So you know what? Honestly, Peter, I've had enough of Alaska. I maybe someday I'll return there for some story.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had enough with Alaska. Enough of Alaska. But I did have a chance a couple weeks ago to attend that Keepers of the Flame 20th anniversary dinner. I know you've talked about this. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, Dick Cheney was there, and it was obscene. Don Rumsfeld, and then Scooter Libby accepted some award for, being a mafia guy who kept his mouth shut. And as he went up to accept it, he had to genuflect to Cheney. And
right.
I just thought to myself, where are the subpoenas? Where are the arrest warrants? What's wrong with our Justice Department? They're all in one place.
You know, it's weird. If I did a little research on this, there was a movie called Keeper of the Flame. And going way back when, Katharine Hepburn was in it, Spencer Tracy. But the funny thing about the movie was the hero in the movie, who winds up dying, is secretly a fascist. See, I mean, what kind of a Freudian slip are we talking about here where they name their event after this? I mean, are they secretly telling us that they are fascists? I mean, it's hilarious. I can't even believe that they're using that name. But you mentioned some of the people. Don Rumsfeld introduced Dick Cheney. Cheney, of course, any opportunity he gets, he will criticize the current administration, criticized Obama for waffling on Afghan strategy, like the Bush administration had a real clear idea of what they were going to do there. Said that the White House must stop dithering while America's armed forces are in danger. He was a guy that always cared so much about the troops. And I like this one, too. He claims he and George Bush handed Obama, quote, a record of success. So, I don't know. History through Dick Cheney's eyes is kind of interesting. It might be fun to live in his bubble, though, right? I mean, a bubble where you clog your arteries and you shoot people and you have a rather skewed vision of history.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it is a bubble. Is there any way we can burst it?
Good question. And you might wonder what I was doing at this dinner. Was I a waiter? No. What I was, Peter, I was keeper of the humans. There were some still some hurricane refugees, some people from the Middle East, Dick Cheney likes to hunt right after he eats.
I see. And you orchestrated that for him. Tommy Panik, our low-budget, in-depth undercover investigative reporter, exclusive to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.